Let's first wrap up experiment two, because although we have almost finished it, I had not talked about the lab report for that experiment yet. So I have already made the change on the website as far as the date. Since I'm just now explaining it today, your lab report will be due a week from today. Now, I miscalculated this morning. Somehow, I thought it was going to take much longer for the section to complete today's experiment. And so I didn't think we were going to have time to do the chemical stain today. Turns out that was incorrect, but I don't have the chemical stain ready since I thought I would have a couple more days to get it ready. So, go ahead and start working on your lab report, though. I'm going to describe everything you need to write that report. We'll just get a little more backup data on Wednesday that you could slip into your report and then turn in. This will also give me a chance to finish grading your first lab report so you can get some comments back before you have to turn your next one in. And I figured that you would have preferred that I focused on your exam since that's worth a lot more points. So that's what's coming back to you first. Yes? The TLC report is due Monday, a week from today. So the 31st, Halloween. The SN1, SN2 will not be due at least for a couple of weeks because I won't have you turn it in until we've officially tackled that topic as an official lecture topic. You, based off the introductory lecture that we had, you in theory have enough information to write a report for that. But because I may make one exception for that report, I may have you discuss a little theory on that report and just that report. Then I'd rather wait till we get it properly in lecture first. So just put Lab 3 on pause for the moment. Lab 4 will be due in the future on time. So we have the first day of the lab today, next day of lab next on this following Wednesday. Next week on Monday, that's our third day of the lab. Of course, it happens to be our lab quiz as well. But then a week from that Monday is when Lab Report 4 will be due. All right, so let's come back to lab report two for the moment. Again, lab two, due on the 31st. That is also additional reason why you should go ahead and start working on your lab reports this week so that all of you who are incapacitated over the weekend because of the various Halloween parties, factor that into your scheduling as well. Get your work done before you can't. What would be a reasonable purpose statement for this experiment? Based on the types of data you collected, if you had to create some purpose statement that didn't say to learn how to do TLC, what would you say? Yes? Not necessarily for two unknowns, because you really only had to do one, but it would be if your unknown, for example, had multiple spots, that your goal is to identify the components of an unknown tablet or an unknown mixture. Now, like lab one, I won't write that down because I want you to work a little bit on wordsmithing, but that is the point. You had these five reference compounds that you're comparing to either your crushed up tablet or your unknown mixture. The point is that if the RF value, which we'll review how to calculate RF momentarily, if that RF value for an individual spot matched a spot that was in your compound, then we're saying that means that that reference compound is in your unknown compound. So since you checked against all these different reference compounds, that's why a logical purpose statement is to identify the components of an unknown. Unknown analgesic or analgesic mixture. What forms of data did you acquire in this experiment? Okay. And what specifically did you measure for those spots? The distance. Along with the spots, what other distance did you measure? The solvent front, that's right. You had to be really careful to make sure you wrote that solvent front down because the solvent front's distance is one of those things that goes into the RF calculation. So under data, I would say the solvent front distance for each plate. You know, I had warned you ahead of time, you might not be able to fit all of your samples on one plate. And so if you did develop multiple plates, you needed to get the solvent front distance for each plate. Then we had the compound distance for the reference samples. And you had your unknown dot or dots. So if you ended up with multiple spots for your unknown, that doesn't mean something went wrong. That just means you might have more than one compound that's in your unknown. So I'll put an S in parentheses here. Are there any other forms of, I'm sorry, yes? Solvent front distance means from the starting line, how far did the solvent travel through up to the top of your TLC plate? So if you had... So there's the starting line. You don't measure from the bottom of the plate, you measure from the starting line, because that's where the solvent first interacted with your compounds. And then wherever the solvent stopped, that's the solvent front. So you're measuring the distance between those two. Well, the solvent front distance is independent of the known or unknown. It's how far the solvent went. Yes? Right. And which is a perfectly valid piece of evidence to say, oh, well, if I see that glowing dot in another place, like the unknown, or did you see for unknown or unknown? Do you remember? Then that's a good piece of evidence that that particular known was in your unknown. So you can use the colors of the dots themselves, which is why when we do the stain, that may be a bit of backup evidence for you. So you could use the color of the spots. And exactly the example that Max gave, that if you had something that glowed unusually under the UV lamp, that just happens to mean that compound's UV reactive. And so if you happen to see that same bright spot again in your unknown, logical deduction to say, ooh, since that's the only one of my reference compounds that glowed like that, if it glows like that for the unknown and you have the same RF value, two pieces of evidence that that might really be the compound that's in your unknown. Now, if you didn't take down color observations, don't make them up, but color would be a perfectly valid form of data in this kind of experiment. Do we have any other forms of data? No, because we didn't measure temperature and all the reaction conditions, they were fixed for us. So this is it in terms of data. What about calculations? Well, you're only really going to have one type of calculation, which is the RF value, the retention factor. RF factor is the distance that a compound travels versus the solvent front. So all values of RF better be less than one. Nothing could travel faster than the solvent. Nothing should have, to my knowledge, traveled at the same distance as the solvent. Did anybody end up with a spot that they felt traveled the same distance as the solvent? Okay, good. So everything should be less than one. You should, as we went over last time, show one example calculation of this. So use one set of data to show how you made your RF value. But just like last time, where I suggested it would be okay for you to combine tables from your data and calculation sections. You know, last time, what was it? We were doing percent composition. And so I said that next to where you were listing the mass of a particular layer, maybe it would make sense to add a column at the end where you show where that percentage is. It logically fits together. Same thing here. If you have your list of the compound distances, it might make sense in the next column over to just say, what is that RF value? Even though it's a calculation, it makes sense to put it together. Still keep your calculation itself, though, the showing of that work in your calculation section. So you'll calculate all the RF values, and that's what you use to identify what's in your unknown mixture. Because if the RF of your compound, one of those reference compounds, matches the RF of one of those spots, then you're going to say that is the compound that's in your unknown. If you had multiple spots in your unknown, then hopefully you'll have multiple matches with your compound. But a question came up this morning. Someone said, well, you know, I've got more than one spot in my unknown, but I can't find a compound spot it matches up with. That might be possible, because I somehow remember we used to have 6 reference samples in the past, which is why I stumbled for a minute on how many we really had. If not 6, then we might have had different reference standards in the past. So it could be that unintentionally we didn't give you enough reference compounds to identify everything in your unknown. And so if you didn't have it, there's nothing wrong with saying the dot or that component could not be identified. So, one way or another, that's what you're going to express in your conclusion. Which maybe, like the purpose statement, I won't write a conclusion statement this time. But I'll just tell you the types of things you might say. If the purpose was to determine the composition of an unknown tablet or mixture, your conclusion statement should be, the composition of that tablet or mixture is, and then list out whatever you think you identified. If, as I said a moment ago, you feel that you might have something you can't identify, nothing wrong with saying that. You could say one of the components of the unknown mixture was demonstrated to be ibuprofen. However, there was another component of the unknown that could not be identified using the reference compounds provided. Perfectly valid conclusion statement. Now, do you need to discuss anything? Well, I know that there's this kind of nebulous worry out there of, oh my gosh, if my lab report's only 1 page long, I'm going to get credit off, so I better write something in the discussion section to make it feel like a real lab report. Except what happens so often in those lab reports is you write something just to fill it in, and you start with what's a good idea, but then you start putting bad chemistry in. You start saying things from like thermodynamics or equilibrium that you don't really remember, but you know you're supposed to worry about it. So it's nice and big and fluffy, but it's not necessarily correct. And I don't want that kind of discussion. If it's something that specifically you think went wrong with your experiment that would explain why you didn't get the results you thought you should have, that's the type of thing that you could put in your discussion section. So for example, if you had a TLC plate and your dot was this big relative to your plate, and if the starting line was here, well, the bottom of the dot might have an RF value of 0.5, the top of it might have an RF value of 0.9, so anywhere in there could theoretically be what really the RF value should have been. But this is the first time that you've done, for most of you, TLC before. So you didn't know your dots were going to end up that huge. And so in the future, you know to avoid that. A logical thing to put in your discussion section might be, well, due to inappropriate technique, the spots obtained were too large to make an accurate assessment of the RF value. That's something reasonable you could say. If you just said, well, you know, the atmosphere might have been a little dry that day, so the solvent might not have evaporated as quickly, or maybe the filter paper wasn't totally saturating the chamber, now you're just starting to make up excuses, things that you don't know were true or not. So keep your discussion focused on concrete sources of error, if you're even going to refer to them. One last reminder that I don't normally have theory on the lab report, so you don't have to tell me that the RF values were different because the polarities are different. That's what should happen. So questions then on this second lab report. Yes? Compound distance would be how far does one of your reference compounds travel from the starting line up to wherever it ended. So if that's one of your spots, then this is the compound distance. And then the green line I wrote earlier, that's the solvent front distance.
So the solvent front is the highest?
Solvent front better be the highest of anything that you saw on your TLC plate. And quite probably it had kind of a bar or a line look to it, whatever might have gotten dissolved up in whatever crap was left over in your development chambers. Probably rode up with the solvent front and made a hazy line up at the top. That should be the highest point on your TLC plate. All of your real spots should have been below that. Yes?
For the compound distance recipes, since we have like a whole job, so we can measure what is that
like to
the top of the dot?
No, normally you would measure right in the middle of the dot. As much of the middle as you can determine. Now, if you have a dot that's shaped like this, now what you might end up with, some really odd-shaped dots. This could be one of two things. You either have a compound that partially stuck to the plate, but for the most part progressed, and so I'd actually ignore the bottom of this totally and just go right in the center of the block and identify that as the center. Another possibility is you've got some byproduct in a very small amount, which is why the dot size here is relatively small. It might be close enough in polarity that that's why it overlapped a little bit with the top. But generally, you measure to the center of the dot.
What if you don't have a dot in here, but there's like a long trail?
If you have a long trail, then you have to just, as best as you can, figure out where that center is. And then that's why I was mentioning that in your discussion section, you might want to say that that occurred, and that is an explanation why your RF values might not be as accurate as you'd like. Yes? Actually, in a conclusion, no. Conclusion is just going to be the composition is whatever it happens to be. And then in the discussion section, if you have some concrete sources of error. Yes, you can discuss those in the discussion. If you read the syllabus, I give you the full list of the types of things that you could put in the discussion section. No. Hadn't changed the way I prefer to handle discussion sections. The basic rule is, unless you directly knew it was a source of error, don't talk about it. They'll make up things to put into the lab report. That's one aspect. But you, and that's the other part, right. You don't have to discuss theory, because there's plenty of chance on the lab quiz on Monday for me to ask you all, how does all this work? Yes? Yes, just by using a ruler. I'd recommend millimeters, just so you get a finer division. Or if you're using centimeters, report more than one sig fig after the decimal point. Other questions?
Why?
Because distance itself can change depending on how long your TLC plate is. But the ratio that your dot travels versus the solvent should be the same from plate to plate to plate. So you calculate RF and compare RF values instead of comparing distances. Yes? Do I have what? Do I have reference, like actual the real values? In theory, they could be. If you have really different material, then in theory, a spot might travel a little differently. And especially if you start changing solvents, then it'll start moving different distances. And so there is something that we discovered, I think, maybe in this section, that there were multiple styles, multiple kinds of TLC plates around. And so that would be another potential source of error if you tested the same compound twice but got different RF values. If you had two different TLC plates, that might explain it. Other questions about second lab? Yes? No, that's why I was talking about RF. Distance can change with the length of your TLC plate. So if you did your experiment on multiple TLC plates, you can't use distance unless your starting lines were written exactly the same place and the solvent front traveled the same amount. Even if you did everything on one TLC plate, which if you did, technically you could just use distance by itself. But because the distance depends on how big the plate is, we never report that. We report these RF values. The RF value makes the result independent of the TLC plate, as long as you're using the same kind of plate under the same conditions. Yes, that was a question that was asked earlier. Should we use the color information? The answer is yes. Because that can help you identify what the compound is. So if you had one of your reference compounds glow and part of your unknown glow, then that might be a good clue that that reference compound was one of the things in your unknown. More questions about lab number two. Yes?
What if your solvent front is not a straight line, it's kind of one size?
If it's tilted like this,
yeah.
Well, then check the bottom of your plate. Maybe your starting line was also tilted, or maybe the TLC plate itself was tilted.
So what?
You still got to measure from the line to the solvent front. And I guess what you're really asking is how to measure. So if you had a situation like this, if you drew your starting line straight, but your solvent line was crooked, then, well, that's a tough case. Because then you'd have to look at the bottom of your TLC plate. If the bottom of your TLC plate is also crooked, then go ahead and measure just from your starting line straight up parallel to the side of the plate up to your solvent front. If the bottom of your TLC plate was flat, you'll still have to do that, but it's more likely your results won't quite be right then. More questions? All right, how many of you still need to finish up experiment three, the SN1, SN2 experiment? Ooh, so more in this section than the other section. So, as far as handling the chemicals, I think this section already got the warning that alkyl halides do have the possibility, at least, of being slightly carcinogenic. So we want to reduce how much exposure that we have. We also want to reduce whatever mess we might create of having them all spread out and everyone using pipettes and little spots of them showing up all over the benchtops. The thing I'm even more concerned about is cross-contamination of the different samples. So, for those of you who need to measure out more of the SN1, SN2 reagents, please do the following. Maybe right at the beginning of lab, before anybody really needs their fume hoods, we could spread the bottles out a little bit. Do keep them in the fume hoods to reduce our exposure. Put one pipette for each bottle, and you only use one pipette. One of the sections last week, when I said to use the pipettes like that, and one pipette for each bottle and leave it there for the whole class to use, as soon as I was done talking, five people had their own sets of pipettes, which means they completely ignored what I just said, which means we ended up with waste bottles back there filled with just pipettes. So to reduce the amount of waste and to reduce the possibility of cross-contamination, whoever's the first to use the alkyl halides, get a pipette, put it next to that bottle, and please only use that pipette for that bottle. And then, as far as waste, all the waste from experiment two will go into the organic waste bottle. Are there any questions what you need to do for the SN1, SN2 lab? Then, well, last word of caution, because I got a little annoyed with section one today. When I went to clean up the lab afterwards, the chemicals had pretty much been put back into one place. That wasn't the problem. But half the lids were just kind of slopped on and not actually closed. So I don't know, I don't understand why, as college level students, it takes me more than one time to explain to you that to close a bottle, you really do have to close it. If you just put the cap on, if you were to sit there and smell that bottle, you'd know that the compound is still able to get out. A seal is only a seal if you make a seal. So you make sure that you close those bottles, please. Now, let's talk about the lab that you're starting today then. Before I show you the mechanism for the day's lab, I want to show you another SN1 example mechanism from last week. Because what we saw last week is something like this. If you had a tertiary alkyl halide, then that halogen could come off with enough thermal energy. If you had water as a solvent, water could now be the thing that comes and attacks in. And then we have a deprotonation step. Ending up with an alcohol. But if you read over the theory at all for this current experiment, you know we're about to do exactly the opposite. We're going to take this starting alcohol, 2-methylpentane-2-ol, also sometimes called T-pentyl alcohol. We're going to react it with what? Concentrated hydrochloric acid, HCl. It's going to make T-pentyl chloride, what last week we saw as a starting reagent. You might think, wait a minute, does that mean that this reaction, you can cause it to go either direction? Yes. And soon, I'll write it this way starting the day, in fact, but soon you're going to need to know that sometimes a reaction step is reversible, meaning that there's an equilibrium that can happen for an individual reaction step. So in this reaction of concentrated HCl with an alcohol, the first step of that reaction will be the alcohol attacking an H+. But that's not necessarily an energetically favorable process, because you're going to be making an oxygen that's plus charged. So as soon as that hydrogen hops on, it can fall back off again. And so let me point out, this is our first use of a reversible reaction. First use of a reversible reaction, arrow. Later on, it will matter whether you write it one direction or both directions. For the moment, just go ahead and copy it down, because once we have our equilibrium lecture on Friday, isn't it? Equilibrium? Then we'll get more into reversible reactions. Now, just for clarity's sake, though, let me contrast this arrow with one we saw last week, which also points in two directions. But notice the arrow used in this reaction, the mechanism, has an arrow pointing one way up top and the other direction on the bottom, and there are two separate lines to show those two different directions. The arrow I just wrote off to the side is only one line, but had arrowheads on both sides. That's used for resonance structures. And generally, it's not allowable to swap those arrows. So if we are talking about reversible reaction step, make sure you're using this double arrow. Whereas for a resonance structure, we use a single but double-headed arrow. So, OH group attacks plus charge. Not necessarily favorable, so the oxygen tries to become neutral again, which means the hydrogen could fall back off and we go back to the start, or every once in a while, maybe instead of the hydrogen coming off, the carbon-oxygen bond will break. If so, that's going to leave us with a carbocation, which if there's a lot of water around in solution, it'd be possible for the water to come back and attack. But because water is a separate layer in this reaction, it might not be the thing that mainly predominates. And because we have concentrated hydrochloric acid, there's going to be a lot of chloride around. And so it's possible the chloride will attack instead, which is then how we end up with our product. Now, a bit of terminology I didn't want to forget to mention. We're doing this reaction in a little bit unusual way because we're doing the reaction neat, which means not using a solvent. You have two different layers that are going to form during this reaction. Your aqueous layer and then the product, which is not going to be polar enough to be water soluble. Now, question for you, though. In all these cases where we're going to form multiple layers, which one's going to be on top? Your organic layer, which is your product, or the aqueous layer? Does it actually tell you that in the procedure? No? How do you know it's the organic, then? You guessed. Because usually organics are less dense than water, so normally you'd be right, and today you'd be right as well. We looked it up earlier this morning. I think it was a density of 0.866. Let me double check that since we're quoting the number, we should know what it really is. So it's a chloromethyl butane, 0.866 grams per milliliter, less dense than water, it should be your top layer. But this is still unusual because you're just not using any form of solvent. What is the reaction procedure? How do you start this reaction off? If you happen not to have done your pre-lab, you'll want to pay particular attention to how you start this reaction off. Because those of you who did do your pre-lab, what does it say to do? What should you not do at first? Don't put a stopper on your separatory funnel, because there's a lot of pressure that might be generated at first. It most likely would be HCl vapor that comes out of the solution. So I advise you to do the shaking in the fume hood. But it's just warning you that you might get some vaporization. So you're supposed to swirl the reaction mixture somewhat vigorously, not so much that it comes spilling out of your separatory funnel, but get it agitated without putting the stopper on it. Then once it's had a chance to react and not as much pressure might be building up, then it recommends putting the stopper on. Now, before I go any further, to reduce how much we're using in terms of chemicals, because it just seems kind of ridiculous for every one of you to be playing with 25 milliliters of concentrated hydrochloric acid, we're going to cut all quantities in this experiment by 1/5. So that means instead of 10 milliliters of alcohol, you use 2. Instead of 25 milliliters of hydrochloric acid, we use 5. Do not use pipettes to get the hydrochloric acid out. If you need help transferring, transfer it to a beaker first and then pour out of that beaker into your graduated cylinders. Now, all the subsequent washes, which we'll talk about what washing is in a moment, all the different washes cut the quantity by 1/5. When you get to the point where you need your drying agent, remember what the description was of how you know that you have enough drying agent from your first lab. And the way we discussed that was that if you add the drying agent in and it clumps up, that means it's reacting with water. After clumping up, if there's still some left, some powdery stuff left, that means you had more reagent, more drying agent than water, and so it meant that you had successful drying. If all you have is the clumps, then you don't know if you had enough drying agent or not. And so then add a little bit more until you do see some powdery drying agent left. So don't ask me how much to use, because that's the way to determine how much you need. But to start the reaction, all you have is the alcohol and HCl, about as simple a reaction as you get. You swirl it around until the pressure drops off a bit, then you put the cap on your separatory funnel, turn it upside down, shake, vent, shake, vent, shake, vent, just like the first experiment. And when you turn it back over, you're going to form two layers, aqueous layer and organic layer. Based on density, we determined that it should be that the organic layer is on top. How could we prove that if we weren't sure, if we wanted to make sure? pH, maybe, maybe not, because it's possible you might end up with something acidic in your organic layer. Not impossible. Yes? And what would happen? How could you use that? So, if you drop it at the drop, at the top, and if the top layer is your aqueous layer, that drop that you drop in combines right away, because water combines with water. If that top layer is not the aqueous layer, though, then when you put drops of water in, they'll go through the top layer and combine with the bottom layer. That's how you can know which layer is which. I would recommend you might try that just in case, although pretty quickly, those of you who get it to work, you'll tell which layer is your organic or your water layer, because one's a lot smaller than the other. One's 2 milliliters, one's 5 milliliters. So from that alone, you can kind of tell. But if you're not sure, use the trick of adding a couple of drops of water. Yes? While it's in the separatory funnel, best, because then whichever layer is the water goes into it. Otherwise, if you've already separated and you add water to the wrong one, then what are you going to do with that extra water? You could just use drying agent to get it out. That's what you'd do in real life. But why go through the extra hassle if you didn't have to? So you're going to do the separation, or you're going to do the reaction. You're going to let the layers separate, assuming the bottom layer is water. What do you do with it? drain it out and get rid of it, because all you care about is the organic layer in this reaction. So since that layer you're going to drain off is hydrochloric acid, that layer needs to go into the acid waste. If you look over to your right and in the back of the classroom, I've got the acid and the waste buckets sitting right here. I'm looking at them right now. In fact, I'm going to walk over to Chris somehow this morning. They got pointing at everybody's empty. This right here, this is the acid and base waste, and I'm keeping them separate because we can't keep them in the same secondary waste as the organic waste, and the organic waste is growing rather large in that field. So experiment two, the SM1SM2 experiment, is actually the only experiment that you need to be dumping organic. I'm sorry, did I say experiment two? Experiment three, the SM1SM2. That's the only one that would have any organic waste that you might be generating today. So anything from that experiment does still go in the very, very back in the organic fumaroles. But that HCl layer that you get after you first do the reaction, that needs to go into the acid waste. But besides doing the reaction, we have four washes, don't we? Two? They told me four this morning, and I believed them. Well, immediately after you do the reaction, what's the next thing you do? What do you wash with first? And those are two separate washes. Oh, yes, you don't do them simultaneously. No, you don't at all, which is why I want to make sure I go over what is a wash. So a wash is a treatment of an organic layer where you care about the organic layer, not the wash itself. Let me jump to one of the other washes and explain why you're doing it so you can understand what the purpose of a wash is. Let's say we did this reaction, but let's say that there's some non-zero trace of hydrochloric acid that stays in the organic layer. Well, you might want to get rid of that before you try to purify your compound, just in case if that extra acid has some kind of negative effect on your compound. So what you can do is shake the organic layer up in a mixture of sodium bicarbonate. The bicarbonate would react with the acid and leave just water and carbon dioxide, which would then combine with the aqueous layer that the bicarbonate would have been provided in. So you do that, it's effectively going to remove some of that excess acid from the organic layer. But you don't care about the aqueous layer. That's just what you had the bicarbonate dissolved in, and that's what's taking some of the impurities away. So once you've mixed it all together, you're going to drain out and throw that aqueous layer away and only keep the organic. That's why it's called a wash, because you start with the organic, you add something else, you mix it up, and then you drain and keep only the organic. And then you do it with the next wash separately. Add it in, shake it, drain it out. The next wash, same thing. Add it in, shake it up, each time draining out the aqueous layer. So the aqueous layers do not get combined with each other. Shall I draw a little diagram of what a wash is then? Yes. You know, I actually think it's kind of curious the order they're doing the washes in, and I couldn't think of a good enough reason this morning why they did it in the order that they did it. So I'm going to have to go consult with someone and see if there's something about this mechanism I'm just not thinking of. Let me show you what the washes are first, and then I'll tell you why I think this is, it's not wrong, you're going to get the right product, but I'm just curious why did they do it in the order that they did. So first, how does a wash work? You're going to start with the organic in your separatory funnel. So you're going to add the wash, which again, if we're correct with our assessment of density, that the organic layer is less dense than water, it should float on top. The aqueous layer should be on the bottom. You add the washing, you put the stopper on, shake, vent, shake, vent, shake, vent, just like we did with extraction. This is like extraction, except you're not extracting anything except byproducts. That's another way of saying it. So after you've added it, and then you shake and vent, then you drain and dispose of the aqueous layer. Now the first one you're using is saturated sodium chloride. Saturated, the term means you have the maximum amount of sodium chloride in that solution possible. I don't know what the molarity is offhand, although we could look that up and calculate it. But it's not really important, because the way you make it is just pour a whole bunch of salt in and keep pouring in till no more goes in. So it's not even something necessarily you measure, you just prepare it that way. Why are we doing the wash with sodium chloride? Because salt helps make the water layer more polar, and so this is to help pull out any really polar components from your organic mixture. Now, it's not necessarily being used in this way, but this is another reason why you'd use sodium chloride. Is what if you do the reaction and your layers won't separate? That might happen if you've got something that in that aqueous layer that might be slightly organic soluble. So maybe the compound is bridging, you could say, the organic and water layers. Or it could be the solvent that you're using might not be completely hydrophobic. So in those cases, if you need to help separate the layers, again, sodium chloride is there to increase the polarity of that aqueous phase, make it even less organic-like, and then the layers will more easily separate. What's the second wash? The bicarbonate, right? Why do you think that we're using the bicarbonate? That's what I said a moment ago, to remove excess acid. Your third wash is a water layer, which you're using just quote unquote pure water to have one last chance to remove aqueous soluble impurities. Curiously enough, there's one more salt wash, at least according to the morning section. So one more sodium chloride wash. Why one at the end? That's the one I'm not kind of sure about. So if I can find out why we're doing that, what I'll make sure to tell you. But it is your fourth wash, and after which you're left over with just your organic layer. Which, what are you supposed to do with that organic layer? Dry it using a drying agent, correct? Then what? After you dry it and filter it and all that? You can pasture pipette it to filter it, and then? And we're not going to distill. That's going to save us an enormous amount of time, and the reason we're not distilling is because we're making so little material. When it says short path distillation, that's an even smaller and actually more expensive piece of glassware than what you have in your kit even. Your kit can do distillations. We will do them later on. But for 2 grams of material, too small an amount to make the distillation worthwhile. So we're actually going to characterize the product as if we were doing the microscale procedure, which is we dry it and that's it. We don't do any more preparation with that material. So where you need to get to by the end of today's experiment is to have done the mixing, done the reaction, do your four washes, get your product material in drying agent, and then stopper it. Today, instead of using stoppers, in fact, I would recommend instead that you use the glass stoppers. Instead of rubber stoppers, use glass stoppers, which I know I must have said this at least once, but I still see people trying to do it. If you're going to use a glass stopper, you must use a ground glass joint piece of glassware that it goes with. The glass stoppers will not fit in your Erlenmeyer flasks. Well, they might, but they won't cause any kind of seal because your Erlenmeyer flask is smooth. It's not designed to fit with the stopper, so it will not work as a stopper. Yes?
You're anticipating me. So, yes, if you're using ground glassware to prevent it from sticking or what we call freezing, you need to use a little itty bitty tiny bit of grease. Now, from where you're sitting, I'll go ahead and push out the amount of grease that is enough to use. But if you can't see it from where you're sitting, that's the point. That's how small the amount can be used. You just get a little tiny blob of it on your stopper. Stopper in and twist it, it'll make a seal. And you can see if it's making a seal or not. So you'll know if you've got too little. It's almost impossible to err on the side of too little unless you're just being really, really overly cautious. It is so easy to use too much grease.
So, because these alkyl halides tend to be quite volatile, I'm recommending that you use ground glass joints with grease to store your products between now and Wednesday. And it's okay to leave them on the drying agent. Get them nice and dry for when we do our characterization on Wednesday. Remember that if we're leaving anything in our drawers, we do have to label what it is. So don't forget to slap a label on it before you leave. After doing the stopper, always a good idea to do parafilm as a backup. I guarantee your product will be gone Wednesday if you only use parafilm, though. So you have to do a proper stopper. Then you can follow it by parafilm. And then use one of those yellow Keck clips to help hold the stopper onto the glassware. Which, if you're not sure how to use one of those Keck clips, because I haven't described it yet, come up and ask me and I'll show you how to use it. So, SN1, SN2, people, go ahead and work. You've got plenty of time to finish the experiment today. Nobody left without finishing. So you got plenty of time to go back and measure those chemicals out. Again, please make it assembly line style. One dropper for each bottle. And don't use multiple droppers.